Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Chet Haas from the Android Toolkit team.
Hello, I'm Yid from the Android UI Toolkit team.
Because we have forced Tor out. He doesn't know this yet, but we'll let him know. As a guest today, we have...
I'm Chris Craik from the Android Toolkit team.
Excellent. Everybody from the same team. It's just easier to organize a podcast like this. So, Chris, this is your second time on the podcast?
Yes.
We tried to get you on several other times, but you just kept bailing on us. And we had you on before, probably to talk about graphics and performance.
Yes. Yeah.
So what are we going to talk about today?
So we're going to talk about graphics and a couple of other things.
Mostly performance related. Yep. I would say, like, you always have that lens that you view our code through, right? Like, how can I make stuff faster? What I have observed in the last year or two is you sort of stepped up the stack from graphics, which you had been working on for years, to look at more comprehensive performance problems.
Yeah, absolutely. Android, and that's kind of one of the things I wanted to talk about is, like, slowly stepping up the stack from graphics and looking at other bigger things. Right.
Okay. Well, let's start at the bottom of the stack anyway. What's going on in graphics, or what has gone on?
So in the most recent release, the Pi release, we've done a major change to the graphics engine and switched to a completely different implementation, that of the Skia renderer. And now the Skia renderer is a complete replacement for everything that we've done underneath the canvas level. So all of the hardware accelerated pipeline has been completely swapped out from underneath you. And hopefully, as an app developer, you haven't noticed or cared.
Actually, if you've noticed anything, maybe you've noticed that it handles some bugs went away. For example, I bet that it actually draws really large glyphs now instead of just dropping those on the floor.
Yes. And so the main reason here is that we had a lot of little, fun features of the old renderer that would say not draw glyphs if you got them over a certain size or paths over a certain size, not handle scaling and certain details in certain ways. And by switching to the Skia renderer, we switched to an implementation owned by this team that is much more aware of and in control of a lot of those, like, corner cases that handle that a lot better.
We should point out, too, that it's not that we switched to an entirely new renderer. It's that we already use Skia for all of our software rendering and for path rendering and for glyph rendering, font rendering, but rather that we enabled Skia for everything. So if you were using hardware acceleration before, you would basically take a sidestep through our own code that would go all the way down to issuing GL commands.
Yeah, absolutely. And before we get too much into this, maybe it would be good to step back a little bit and talk about what the renderer is.
What is rendering?
What is it? So the renderer is the part of the system that takes the drawing commands that you're used to as an application developer, where you have, like, canvas.draw rect, draw text, draw circle, all of these primitives, plus, you know, different things that mix into that, your paints that control how those primitives are filled. The renderer is the stuff that takes all of that and gets it to the GPU. Now, if you're not very familiar with how GPUs work, GPUs don't work on the granular. They don't take text. They don't take circles. They only handle triangles and textures. That's basically about it. So there's a whole lot of translation work that has to be done to turn something like the letter T in the middle of a big string of text.
T, which is in the word triangle.
It is.
So that one's going to be an easier letter.
I'm glad you caught that. Yeah. So to take a letter like that and translate that into something that can actually show up on the screen. So In the case of text, you have to you generally will want to rasterize, turn those into bitmaps on the CPU, and then upload those to the GPU so that you can reuse those individual those pieces of a texture over and over again. With something like circles, you might have to tessellate that and turn that into triangles, because a circle, a GPU can't draw, but triangles can.
So circles are triangles?
Circles are triangles, yes. You heard it here first.
So actually fitting a round peg into a square hole isn't really a problem, since they all just devolve into triangles anyway.
Absolutely. Okay. So stepping even further back, let's step back in time to what Android originally did.
A long time ago in an Android platform far, far away.
Far away. It was using software rendering for everything. So back in the original Android releases, up through Gingerbread, Android would render everything immediately through software. That means that the CPU not only had to deal with everything that your view system did, handling all of the scrolling events, manipulating views, moving them around on the screen, but it also had to, immediately after that, slam out a whole bunch of pixels for everything on the screen that had changed since the previous frame. And obviously, this is not ideal because a CPU isn't really well suited to operating on huge amounts of data at once. That's why GPUs exist. That's kind of their purpose, is to push out pixels, large numbers of them at once. So this was known to be a problem in the time frame of Gingerbread, but by the time that we were switching over to Honeycomb, it kind of came to a head because we had suddenly these much larger screens.
Tablets,
exactly. Mm-hmm. We had these much larger screens that had to run at 60 frames a second that just couldn't get anywhere near it. And so at that point, the problem is obvious. We really need to go over to hardware rendering.
With the advantage that, just to try to clarify my understanding here. So instead of rendering everything in the CPU and then sending over gobs of memory over to the display, then instead we can talk a smaller amount of communication to the GPU, which then processes it internally and puts it on a display.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
So it's basically lessening the amount that we're shoving over the pipe to the display.
And computing it in the first place. So like you're talking about the amount of data that you have to push over the pipe. I mean, that's, you know, tens of megabytes on modern phones that you have to produce every frame of graphics information. That's a huge amount of data. And that's a whole lot of data for the CPU to have to produce. So in Honeycomb, the Skia team was the software backend for the Android rendering system. But at the same time, the Android was really pushing into hardware. We really need this done. There was a bit of disagreement about how it should be done. So Roma swooped in and built the entire hardware rendering system from scratch all by himself.
Yes.
Over a weekend. Now we know it was wrong.
Ooh. Yeah, that was basically him during the Honeycomb release was building the GPU backend for all of our rendering.
Yeah, and so what this gave was this gave compatibility with all the existing Canvas APIs. They'd render much faster now on the GPU. And most of the APIs that existed worked. So one of the funny features of having to support of going from CPU rendering to GPU rendering is there are a lot of things that are a lot easier on a CPU than a GPU. You can get a lot of performance out of a GPU pretty easily, but there are certain features that just kind of got left behind.
Right, because Skia, the Canvas APIs were basically thin wrappers over Skia functionality and APIs.
Yeah, exactly.
And that functionality was not built in conjunction with GPU capabilities. So you had things like, I remember nested shaders were a problem, like the just figuring out how to do that through, you know, GL commands was non-trivial, and it got dropped.
Yeah, and then there were like compatibility paths put in that were okay but not ideal paths, and simple shapes were all still rasterized. They were all still rendered by the CPU, uploaded to the GPU as masks, which takes a lot of time, which would cause jank whenever you hit a new shape that you hadn't seen before.
Yep.
There were compatibility things like this. There were issues with scale. So one really cool feature about the Android View system is that because all of the display density stuff is handled at the layer of decoding resources, that all of the rendering system just works perfectly in integer pixels. Now, that meant that Roman could, you know, cut a lot of corners, very justifiably, to make everything work at 1.0 scale great, but once you start pushing outside of that, you'd start getting blurry artifacts because, say, these raster images that we'd have, these bitmaps would scale up, they'd get blurry, that kind of thing. So after Honeycomb...
So I should point out, the hardware renderer was off by default in Honeycomb.
Yes,
you had to
exactly.
opt into it.
So
system process, a lot of the built-in Android stuff, the built-in apps would all opt into it, but app developers needed to do that on their own.
In ICS, it became opt-out. So it was on by default once you targeted 14 or whatnot. And with that, it also came a lot more sort of feature completeness of covering the little corner cases in order to make it, to say, hey, this is ready for prime time. This is ready to be the default renderer. There's still a lot of things that weren't quite working perfectly in terms of correctness, but correctness was mostly covered. And then one other big important feature in that release was texture view as well. So texture view was sort of the replacement for surface view at that point. So surface view is this component in the system that allows you to say, embed video content at this associated with this particular view, but it defers all of the actual composition to the compositor. So the problem at that point would be, say you wanted to have a video in a scrolling list, because UIs were becoming more complicated at the time. What would happen then is that your UI view would move around, but because the compositor was asynchronous from your UI drawing, you'd just have that you know, say, embedded video in your scrolling list lag behind the window that it's supposed to be displayed in. So texture view was a fix for this because texture view just said, give me that window, we'll put it into OpenGL, we can draw things that way, and composited it there in the app itself.
Right.
So then as you're scrolling, everything stays perfectly synchronous.
Yeah, I have memories of this very told UX in my previous company that we simply cannot play the videos in the feed because it looks bad. So they had to change the user experience.
Wait, this was using Service View or using Texture View?
This is before Texture View.
Okay.
This is like gingerbread times.
Right. So yeah, Texture View allowed you to then integrate better with a view hierarchy with the trade-off that you introduce latency, because now we had to have the copy step.
Yeah, so there's the copy step, which also means that there's some pretty significant trade-offs there. You're also converting it into the RGB color space. Most mm-hmm. videos aren't in RGB, so you have to convert those and then composite that separately. So it adds latency, it adds extra memory bandwidth cost, but it allows UX that, yep. UX wants. So those are the big things of ICS. And Jelly Bean, that's when I joined the team, was a lot of work into making some of those really nasty slow paths faster.
Yep.
So the first project that I worked on was tessellation for simple
yes,
shapes.
I remember that.
So I remember when I joined the team, there was a particular like app that I was using at the time for Reddit that just had, this big round rect background for some comment text somewhere, and if that post was sufficiently long, you'd get something like 6 frames a second while you were scrolling in the app. And I was like, oh my goodness, why is this? So I looked and dove into it, and it was, oh well, because we are re-rasterizing that path on the CPU every single time that it's drawn. And even though it's a round rect, theoretically most of that is very flat. There's very repeating pattern there. You don't think of something that's 200 pixels or 2,000 pixels tall as being very difficult to draw, but because we have to put that entirely into a CPU bitmap, upload that to the GPU, it's a huge amount of work. It scaled linearly with the size of that particular view. It was terrible. So I worked on instead taking simple shapes like round rects, circles, points, lines, that kind of thing, yeah. And tessellating those, turning those just directly into geometry, relearning how cosine and sine and all of that sort of stuff works, generating triangles manually to fake anti-aliasing because we didn't want to turn on MSAA because it was too expensive, all
yep.
of that stuff.
Yeah, I think I had worked on specifically points and lines as part of the original one, and then you improved my code and then added a whole lot of other primitive shapes as
yes.
well.
Yes, yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and then later on in the Jelly Bean, well, I say release, but there were really multiple releases that we called Jelly Bean, right? There were like 3 of them.
Yeah, MR1 and MR2.
Yes.
What great names. Yep.
And in the later ones, we worked on reordering and batching. So
yes.
one of the fun features of OpenGL is that although it gives you a lot of simple ways to pass information to the GPU, every single time that you have to talk to OpenGL incurs a lot of cost because you're talking to the driver, and the driver has to be really, really sure that you're not doing something wrong. So like if you pass an invalid parameter, if you pass a buffer that's the wrong size, if you call something that is out of order with how you're supposed to call it, the driver can have error fallbacks for all of those things, but there's just a lot of code in the driver to handle every single one of your calls into GL. And this is particularly interesting because your GL calls aren't along the lines of Canvas, where you say, here's my primitive, here's my fill, draw it. They're a lot lower level, and they are really complex and stateful. So instead, what you would say is you'd say, set up this particular shader, set this parameter on this shader, set this to my current texture 1, set this property of texture 1, so on and so forth. And you'd have to do a lot of this. You'd have, maybe 15 calls per draw primitive. So a typical mm-hmm. Android view hierarchy maybe has, 100 drawing primitives that you see on the screen at once. So we'd have many, many of these draw calls into OpenGL. And the big problem that you'd see is you'd just see, like, well, we're paying all the cost of setting up all of this, all of the state in order to draw, say, the icon on the left side of your list item. And then we do everything else for the list item. And then we draw another one that's exactly the same. Yep. Wouldn't it be nice if we could avoid a lot of that GL state churn where we're having to tell it, hey, this is your current texture. Now it's this one. Now back to the first one.
And then this also caused thrashing on the GPU side. It wasn't just our setup stuff, but doesn't it also like flush the pipe inside on the GPU if you're changing the target?
Yeah, it depends on, and it's very complicated as to which causes what flushes. Yep. But switching shaders can also be very expensive. Yep.
So how do you reorder these calls though? Like, do you just sort it in real time?
So that was a very fun project, because basically you have to you do exactly want to do that, right? You want to sort everything in real time. And you want to be able to say, well, I sorted everything last frame, what's different this frame? But that's a really, really complex problem. So instead what we do is we just sort it every frame and do it really fast. and so what we do is we say, for every single draw call that we see, the way that a typical list would look like is you'd say, draw the list background, draw the things on top, iterating over all of those. Okay, now new list item, draw the list background, iterate, so on, so on. So what we would do instead is, as a first stage of the drawing pipeline, we would say, instead of drawing each one of those, defer them into a sorting list. And we would say, if this has this particular shader, then you can try and put them adjacent to one another. If these are the exact same operation, then try and put them adjacent to one another. And there are a lot of gotchas here. You got to be really careful about like the clip aspects of each of them, every single parameter that may change, the drawing properties of it, clip, matrix, so on and so on. Because it's really easy to draw two very simple rectiline unclipped, say, pieces of text and merge those together. It gets way more complicated, or possibly even impossible, if you want to start, say, rotating one of them, clipping one of them, so on and so forth. So we have like,
so that was more like a best effort sorting, yes, instead of like,
yeah, and that's actually sorting. and that's specifically what we realized was, well, because Android UIs, Android views look so very similar, you can actually just tune to what applications are doing. Well, applications have lists of views. Typically, the inner views on list items aren't actually clipped. And you can use a lot of this to recognize, oh, we can actually get a huge amount of benefit by just optimizing for the very common drawing cases.
So I think what Chris is saying to your question is it was really hard. So that was all about the reordering. There was also batching. Was that part of the same effort?
Well,
because
so that,
now you can see like several completely unrelated text items actually go out as a single.
Yeah, so that was the next step of that. That was, I think, MR2 as opposed to MR1.
Oh, okay.
Was merging, where you just recognize these are the exact same bitmap. Instead of drawing twice for that, I can just draw one single time, dynamically create the geometry for it, because it's trivial. It's just like four triangles to draw two bitmaps. And you're good.
Yep.
And you can draw them that way.
All right. So we're partway through the history. Fast forward to what? Were there any? I mean, you did a couple of significant refactors in there, part of it for the reordering and merging. There was another one in there.
Yeah, there were later. I mean, there were some more things on the way.
All in terms of performance optimization.
I know, it was the render thread.
Yeah, we're almost there. So in KitKat.
Sorry, teacher.
That's chapter 7. All right.
So in KitKat, we added PBOs for improving upload speed for text.
PBOs being?
Pixel buffer objects in GL. Yeah.
Which I still don't understand what that means.
We made text faster. Let me just say that. We improved the reordering and merging and so on. But yeah, as Yeet was jumping ahead, L was a really interesting release.
Yes.
L was the release of so many things all happening at once.
Yes.
L was both render thread. So render thread taking all of the GL rendering that we were doing previously on the main thread after your app produces the frame, GL runs immediately, and instead passing that all over to a background thread. And what that did was that allowed us to keep producing frames on the render thread even if the UI thread was blocked. So like the number one feature for this was if you tap an item today on Android, you tap an item, you launch an activity. Well, your main thread is going to be blocked for a while you're launching that activity. So that means that your UI can't do anything for potentially hundreds of milliseconds. However, UX really wants animation to be able to happen there. So what we are able to do is we're able to trigger animations that happen exclusively on the render thread. And so this is how ripples work. When you tap something, it creates a ripple, it creates an animation, and it just sends it off over to the render thread so that it can keep pumping frames. And this is a pretty significant change, because it allows you to actually produce animations in response to an activity launch, which was previously completely impossible. And it also had the really nice side benefit of of taking a lot of the work off of the UI thread and just leaving it a lot more vacant, just generally.
Which we'll get to later. Some of the stuff that we're going to talk about later. So the ability to run animations on the render thread was fairly limited. So there were basically new animations that we were coming up with at the time. It was the ripples. It was circular reveals, which were also part of the material design spec, and animated vector drawables. And we created... all of these,
vector drawables were much later.
Oh, that's right. Yes. We did make them work there eventually. But we had to go with new animations because existing animations had a contract where you could have application code called at any time. So if we send the animation, like for a random object animator, over to the render thread, and then it's going to call the update listener, and the update listener is back in the application code, then you're going to have some sort of frame synchronicity problems, right? Mm-hmm. As it waits for content to come from the application, and then you're going to be locking the threads together, which is a big no-no. So we basically could only do these very specific cases of animations over there as opposed to everything. So to some extent, like unless you're running, you know, that ripple animation, it was kind of business as normal, which is we produce the content on the UI thread, we synchronize the information over to the render thread, and then the render thread continues, right? So if you squint, it kind of looks the same. It's on two threads, but it's kind of the same sort of serial process as we had before. However, and this is why I mentioned it before, it set up things for future releases where we could take advantage of a thread having vacancy.
Yeah, in particular, Recycler View will steal some of its upcoming bind and create work, and it can just schedule it right there.
Yep.
And this is actually a pretty common pattern for applications to recognize that, oh, actually, the best time for me to do non-trivial work that might take 5 milliseconds after a frame, that during a frame, is instead just posted as a runnable. As simple as that, you just schedule it immediately after the frame, and that's when the render thread's running. You've definitely got two CPUs, so you can parallelize these things and not interrupt your UI.
I should point out, too, like all of this... you know, speaking of timing, the timing in the hardware space was around the Lollipop or potentially like the Jelly Bean or KitKat releases. Devices commonly had 2 to 4 cores.
Yes.
Right. So now I assume almost everything out there has 2 to 4 cores.
Yes,
when we originally did the hardware renderer, that wasn't a given. Like we were seeing multiple core devices, but you sort of had to count on one being there. But all of a sudden, if manufacturers are getting performance by having multiple cores, then the way for us to take advantage of that in the toolkit code is to have multiple threads that are doing things that can take advantage.
Yeah, and along those same lines, we were actually like parallelizing shadow computation.
Another
big feature of L.
Yeah.
So we had shadows. We also had outline clipping. So round rect clipping for your views.
There was some text stuff. Was it text? Soft shadows for text were happening.
Soft shadow. Oh yeah, we started doing those with RenderScript. I don't remember which release that was.
Yeah,
unfortunately, it was around then, somewhere along
there.
Yeah.
All right.
But yeah, as exactly you were saying, Chad, because we want to be able to parallelize across multiple threads, we also started putting like path raster over there. So we started turning paths into bitmaps on background threads while some of the rendering is happening, and then we could just basically block on that future when we actually needed to upload it to the GPU.
I should point out that all of this effort and these, you know, person years of slogging away at performance are going into producing your cat videos faster.
That's important.
I hope everyone appreciates
it. Makes people happy.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I do it for.
So you make people happy?
Sure.
That's a nice job title.
Videos.
Yep. Okay. So we're up through the L release.
Nothing happened.
And then we're done.
It was totally working fine, right? There's no bugs.
Nothing to speak of.
It's fine.
Yeah. In the M release, we picked another couple of these big things that were infrequent but very significant sources of jank, where say the renderer would do a whole lot of work on your behalf, very often because you didn't know that what you were asking for was expensive. So in particular, one of the big changes was automatic hardware layers. So last time when I was on the podcast, I was talking about like, oh well, you know, there are these flags that you have to set on your view to get alpha the cheap way. If you don't, then we create a save layer for you, which draws indirectly and like breaks the frame in the middle, causes a pipeline flush, and all of that was, you know, was very useful at avoiding it at the time. But in M, we just went ahead and made it automatic.
It was automatic for that kind of stuff. There was also automatic for like if you set alpha, then we recommended Like if you were using View Property Animator to animate translucency, then you should ask for a layer.
Yes.
And you made all of that automatic as well, right? So as soon as you set the alpha property, you are drawing to a layer because that's the most efficient way to do it.
Yes. Unless we know that you don't need to, but like again, all of that you don't generally need to worry about. We also like rewrote a lot of our GL layer for optimization purposes, and
which is now code that's thrown away.
Essentially. Oh yeah, of course. Okay. I mean, this is all very generational. Yep. And we added swap buffers with damage. So that was an EGL extension that allowed us to tell the compositor. So one interesting optimization that we kind of lost when going from software to hardware is that in software it's very easy to say, well, what was my last frame? Okay, cool. I have that bitmap. What am I drawing now? Okay, well, only this subset of the screen changed. So set a clip to around that area and just draw the new stuff. And hey, I've got the new content. And what that does is that says, like, hey, if you have an action bar at the top or some you know, footer at the bottom that doesn't move, then those things you don't have to redraw every frame. And what we realized in the release is we had this exact same problem on the compositor side. So on mobile devices, typically the way that composition works is that you have hardware that's dedicated to merging together the different layers of the screen. So if you think of system UI, the navigation bar, the status bar, your app itself, maybe a different window that's open at the same time, all of those are different compositing layers, and we have hardware in the devices that will just scan that out to the display. However, one of the things that we were missing out on an opportunity was just we didn't tell the display which portion it had to scan out. So every single frame, 60 frames a second, it was scanning out the entire it was basically passing all of this information to the display. But displays on mobile can actually store all of this information. They can, like, if you don't produce a frame, that's fine. It'll just keep the information from the last frame. So in M, we were able to, you know, hint, hey, you don't actually need to repaint this. This is exactly the same as last frame. And the compositing step, at least, was able to skip that.
So, yeah, was that a savings on the compositor, or was it also the savings on the amount of information we needed to update in that buffer?
So on N, on M, it was just the compositor. On N, we also added further extensions so that we could do that exact same information on the drawing side.
Now, I see.
On the application side, inside the framework where we're drawing, it's a little bit more complicated because instead of having the display having essentially one buffer, there's one buffer that's being displayed right now. In the drawing pipeline, there's typically three buffers. Now, that doesn't mean that we're always triple buffered, but what it does mean is that we have the capability to go into triple buffered if we need to. So what that means is, say, I'm painting a particular frame for, you know, the first frame of my application. The user scrolls a little bit. That frame gets sent to the compositor, but we want to be able to start painting the next one without blocking on the compositor being done with that frame. So we start painting a second frame, same with a third potentially if we need to. And what you realize though is that, like, well, we still want that optimization that we had back in the software days, but that's really difficult to generalize to multiple frames. So what we did is we flattened together all of the damage rectangles, the like basically the bounds of what has changed since last frame, since we saw that frame last. And what that lets us do is say, if we have a 30 frame animation where the action bar is still, well, the action bar is not going to be painted. No, none of the frames are damaging it. We don't need to repaint it.
So I have a question. So when I was developing apps, like, there was this API we used to call, like, you need to invalidate a portion of the wheel.
Good question.
Yes.
So the question is, do we still need to use that or not?
so that API. That's the view.invalidate that takes a rectangle, right?
Yes.
And so what that used to be used for software is it would allow big views to pass a hint as to, this is only the portion that I'm redrawing. This is the only portion that changed. You don't need to redraw everything. What we found over time is that really isn't a useful optimization. What really is useful is knowing which view is invalidated. That tells you in 99.9% of cases what your invalidation rectangle is.
Wait, so it was useless even in software?
It was useful in software because we were taking advantage of it. In hardware, once we rebuilt this in N, we just decided to keep ignoring that rectangle, and I think we've deprecated it.
Yeah, I think in fact it's deprecated now, and it probably just calls invalidate internally.
It basically
does. Whenever anything in a view changes, we will redraw that view, and it turns out to be a pretty fast optimization. So the stuff that he's talking about is more obeying the changed regions on a view-by-view basis.
Mm. Right. Yeah. And that kind of gets into like the details of how the view system works, where we have individual display list cache, basically yes. a cache of all of the rendering commands of a single view stored inside of it, so that we don't need to keep calling your draw command over and over again. Because it's a lot faster in general to just store in native a couple of different references to this is all you drew, I know you haven't invalidated. Yep. And that also gives us the benefit of being able to just send those things directly over to render thread.
So from the graphics perspective, it helps to have more individual views compared to the layout perspective where we prefer like merge views that can do more.
I wouldn't ever recommend that someone start adding views because it's useful for caching, except like in maybe really, really niche scenarios. So in general, you don't want like a big giant single view that's doing everything because mm-hmm. then we can't, because then if you do have any small movement, we can't capture that as a graphics system and recognize that that's a small repaint. So I would just generally say don't worry about it. If you are doing somehow a single view rendering system, then maybe
reconsider that. That was a performance optimization and a pattern that we would recommend in the early days, where to avoid the overhead of, you know, the hierarchy and the views and invalidation and layout and all that stuff, maybe it makes sense to have a more complex view where you handle everything internally in some cases. However, what you end up doing if you know the more complex that view gets and the more types of data it's trying to represent, the more you are re-implementing the entire UI toolkit within that view, right? So now you have to handle accessibility on your own. You have to handle input events on your own. Like, well, when they click on your view, well, where on the view did it click? And then you need to send the event in. And at some point, it just doesn't make sense for you to do that. Why don't you actually rely on the toolkit?
I know,
to
then you join the UI toolkit team. That happened to me.
That's right. I have a complete bias here. But no, like Adam had spoken about this probably on the podcast in terms of like, If you wonder at what granularity you should be using views versus embedding complex content inside of a custom view, if you need to interact with that thing, it should be its own view, right? Like, don't rewrite your own system because maybe it's going to work differently than the stuff around it.
Yeah. So another few features of in that were somewhat interesting. We had save layer reordering. So like if you were hitting the especially slow path of calling canvas.save layer, previously what that would do is that would cause an entire pipeline stall as we would switch rendering targets off screen and back. And that would be a significant performance cost. Our reordering engine was completely updated in to be able to just take those, pull them to the front of the frame and avoid that. There was synchronous surface view. So you know how I was talking about texture view back there? It was a wonderful solution to all of our surface view problems. Well, it wasn't. Those costs of composition and so on are very significant for like about 17% of like, say, playing a video. If you're playing it through texture view, you'll use about 17% more power than if you're using surface view. So surface view is really nice because it avoids a lot of the composition complexity. You don't have to convert that video into RGB, composite it with the UI renderer, and then have the compositor handle it. You can just let the compositor do its job. So in we added a synchronization system between the composition window manager service and the framework where we render inside of an app.
I think a side benefit of that work is now the text selection handles also are synchronous with the content. So there was a historical thing where you could scroll the content and the handles would tend to lag by a frame because they're actually separate windows. If you use hierarchy viewer and look around at all the things going on in the screen, you'll see that those text selection handles are basically small windows.
Oh, yeah. And
they would be updated and moved asynchronously to
And
the
I think
view
everybody,
content.
The first time they found out about it, they were like, why on earth are these separate windows? And then someone would explain, oh, well, because they have to be able to go down over a keyboard that pops out on top of the app.
Right.
And then they go, oh, okay, darn.
Yep. I see why it happened. Okay. That's unfortunate, but I can't think of a better solution, and then you move on. All right, so we're through N. O was not huge.
Not particularly huge.
No
we
major
had,
refactors.
We had the hardware renderer, the hardware bitmap feature.
Oh,
added.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was pretty significant because previously in the hardware renderer, one of the big drawbacks of using bitmaps in general was, well, we have all these APIs that we need to support that are like modifying bitmaps, reading back data from them. And that's all well and good when your bitmap data is resident on the CPU, but if you need to draw it on the GPU, you have to upload that as a texture. And that means a completely separate copy, potentially with like GPU vendor specific rewriting of that data format so that they can draw it more quickly. But what that means is you've got two copies of every single bitmap on the system, and
plus the time to upload it.
Every single time we'd see a new bitmap that's part of the that's part of a frame, we would have to, while UI thread and render thread are exchanging data, upload that to the GPU. And so hardware bitmap was the solution to this, where we just basically break all of the existing expectations of a typical bitmap and instead say, this is a hardware-only bitmap. It is backed by a GPU GPU copy and not a CPU copy. So you can't draw this to a software layer, or if you do, it has extremely high performance costs because we are converting it back. And the primary goal here is, well, 99% of the bitmaps that you load, you just want to display them. You don't care about ever reading them or whatnot. And so this is a big feature to help help reduce, you know, another one of the sources of like bursty work.
So the downside to features like this when we introduce them is it is opt-in. It is a new API that you would have to opt into in your app to take advantage of hardware bitmap, and we would suggest that you do that. On the other hand, it's also things that since we implement things like the system, we can take advantage of it internally to sort of improve the device overall. So I know that Recents took advantage of a hardware bitmap. I don't know if there were other parts
of
system UI.
I think this is one of the things that we really like about having these popular libraries that sit on top of our abstraction sometimes is we just went to Glide and we were like, hey, please use this. And so, you know, there's some constraints there about when you can, but Glide added support for this. And so now you generally just don't have to, you don't have to think about this nearly as hard.
Is one of those reasons why we try to point people to libraries that do these things instead of rewriting it on their own all the time, right?
Yeah.
Just use it. It's there.
Yes. And speaking of Glide and bitmap loading libraries, in we had like sort of worked on this problem by giving those libraries an API to call to pre-upload. But if you have a hardware bitmap, you don't even have to worry about that.
Okay. So this takes us through O, and a coincident with O preview, I believe you gave a talk on graphics architecture. So if you're interested in more details on how some of the stuff works, you can check out one of the I/O talks.
Yeah. And and then after O, as we were talking about at the very beginning, is the big SCIA switch for P.
In fact, we did it in O, but it was opt-in. It was a developer option so that you could try it out and see how it worked for you.
And there were a lot of little gotchas and things. It wasn't quite ready to be turned on yet. But with P, one of the things that was really nice about it is SCIA is the rendering engine for basically everything. Historically, has been the SCIA rendering for basically everything at Google, with the exception of Android rendering.
Right.
And What this meant is that like while we were optimizing our renderer for Android rendering, SCIA was focused on Chrome and other clients and so on for the most part. But as they were turning on to P, we were able to highlight a bunch of these differences of optimizations that we had versus they had and like ingest those into SCIA. So a lot of these like important optimizations that we had for Android views and how Android views typically say clip and are batchable and mergeable and so on, SCIA was able to ingest all of that stuff and provide really nice benefits.
So I should point out too, as you're going through this long explanation of all these optimizations we did over the years, all of that stuff is still in the code, or at least most of the items that you touched on, that is still operational code above the layer of SCIA, right? So the reordering
or within, depending, like
so
SCIA does
so either integrated into what it's doing, we still create the DLOps, the display list, and the DLOps, right? So a lot of the reordering and merging stuff that you talked about is
that's all in SCIA.
Oh, it is. That's pushed into SCIA.
The recording system and so on. I mean, we had benchmarks for all of these things so that we could compare both pipelines, but like most of the implementation of that stuff is just entirely SCIA now.
Okay.
Were we like able to take advantage of other optimizations they did for Chrome?
So a lot of those things we would just get for free, and we weren't really typically worried about. We were mostly making sure that our optimizations weren't getting missed, as opposed to anything else. Some of the really cool things that they were able to do is they have like a completely new shadow rendering system for a lot of the default shadows that is massively faster than our old tessellation based approach. And so that significantly reduces the CPU and GPU cost of rendering shadows. And
there are some situations of path rendering that I think they're
path rendering. Yes,
they're taking advantage of GPU in ways that we were not.
Yeah, and so like a lot of that was like our tessellator could handle arbitrary scales, but it couldn't handle arbitrary paths. It can only handle convex shapes, which is why it was never used for canvas.drawPath. But SCIA has much more robust both analytical engines that can like turn it into some crazy cool shader or tessellate it or whatnot, and they have like lots and lots of nice different alternatives that they can apply.
I wonder how do you verify and test a transition like this? Like, is there large chunk of code you are replacing there?
Yeah, so that was another feature actually added in, I think, the K or L timeframe. Was testing infrastructure for all of this. So we had, I talked about benchmarks, but like the important thing is correctness tests for this stuff, making sure that you don't regress, making sure that you don't have issues when you switch from one rendering pipeline to another. So we have a collection of rendering tests that are asserted in different ways, where you'll say, you draw a specific 90 by 90 pixel area. The 90 by 90 pixel area is important because it needs to fit on even the tiniest Wear watch ever supported. you assert rendering properties of that. So like, say for example, if you're drawing an anti-aliased round rectangle, you might write a test that verifies that it can detect a blurry edge at about the right place. If you're testing that multiple shaders combine in a particular way, you assert that the output colors are the right values in certain quadrants or whatever, and we just have dozens and dozens of those kinds of tests.
They also have a massive testing and benchmarking infrastructure on the Skia side. The part that they were missing that Chris and team were catching with our test was making sure that their renderer was compatible with our renderer and that there weren't performance side effects in switching, you know, in corner cases they didn't handle optimally before. But the stuff that they test on their side specific to, like, are we rendering the right thing is actually really huge. That's one of the advantages of switching to their system, is just sort of more dedication about getting all the pixels correct and knowing they're not regressing at any time. Okay, and then we switched and life is good.
Yeah.
And then Chris came to the dark side.
Anything else we didn't get to?
Wow, we got the whole history of Android.
I think we're done. All right. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.